It's your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC for 20 great years has the best OTR on our live streaming. And continue tuning in to the Radio Book Channel, along with the RTC Music Channel, all at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Welcome and thanks for joining me on this, the RTC Weekly Download, our podcast of old time radio. And we're going to have a few things this week from our regular schedule from the Radio Theater Channel, so that this is kind of a taste test, if you will, of what you can expect to hear on that. We'll start off with an episode of Sherlock Holmes. This is called The Uneasy Easy Chair. It's from May 13th of 1946.
Petri Wine brings you Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce and the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The Petri family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invite you to listen to Dr. Watson tell us another exciting story about his old friend, that master detective, Sherlock Holmes. As for me, instead of telling you something, I'd like to ask you something. Do you like chicken? How do you like it best? Roasted, fried, or in a stew with dumplings? Well, whatever your favorite may be, you'll like that chicken infinitely better when it's served with a glass of Petri California Sauterne. Ah, now there's a combination. Chicken and Petri Sauterne. Petri Sauterne is a white wine, pale golden in color, delicately fragrant, and clear as crystal. And what a flavor that Petri Sauterne has. I'm telling you, Petri Sauterne is just about the last word in dinner wines. Oh, one more tip. Remember to serve Petri Sauterne with fish or any kind of seafood. Good, it's great. To be sure you have a glass of good wine, be sure it's Petri wine. And now I'm sure our good friend Dr. Watson's expecting us. Let's go in and join him.
Come in.
Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Bartell. Punctual to the minute, as usual. Drop a chair and settle down, my boy.
Well, I won't settle down too far, Doctor. You have a habit of keeping me on the edge of my chair during most of your stories.
Just as it should be, Mr. Bartell. I hope tonight will prove no exception, so light up your pipe and I'll get on with my story.
Doctor, from the hints you gave us last week, it sounded like quite a thriller. How did it begin?
On a cold winter morning in 1897, Holmes and I, our breakfast just concluded, sat on either side of a cheery fire in our Baker Street lodgings. A thick fog rolled down between the line of dun-colored houses, and the opposite windows loomed like dark, shapeless blurs through the heavy yellow wreaths.
Another London pea super, huh, Doctor?
Exactly, Mr. Bartell. Our gas was lit and shone its flickering light on the white cloth and glimmer of china, for the breakfast table had not been cleared. Holmes was busy cross-indexing his record of crime, while I was engrossed in one of Clark Russell's fine sea stories. Our morning was not destined, however, to be a quiet one. For shortly after 11 o'clock, Mrs. Hudson ushered a young lady into our room. A young lady who seemed to be in serious trouble. Thank you, Mrs. Hudson. Sit down, won't you, young lady? I'm Dr. Watson, and this is Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
How do you do, gentlemen? I must apologize for not giving my name to your housekeeper, but I have to be so careful.
Yes, we quite understand, my dear.
Of course, you're wondering who I am and what's brought me here.
My own theory would be that you are Miss Harriet Irving, and that you've come to me to elicit my aid in proving that Mr. Binion did not murder your father.
Holmes, what on earth are you talking about?
You're absolutely correct, Mr. Holmes, but how did you know?
I deduced it, Miss Irving. You're wearing very new and extremely expensive mourning, presumably for the first time, since a few basting threads are still in evidence. You wear no rings, so evidently you're not in mourning for a husband. The only man whose death the papers announced in the past few days and who left a young daughter wealthy enough to purchase such garments is Sir Edward Irving. And since the police have already made an arrest, obviously you wish me to disprove the police theory and intercede for young Binion.
Mr. Holmes, you're wonderful. That's just what I want you to do. You will, won't you?
Miss Irving, I've studied the newspaper reports very carefully. It would seem to me that Scotland Yard has arrested the right man.
Well, I'm very sorry, but I didn't read the newspaper reports. I haven't the faintest idea what you're both talking about.
Then let me bring you up to date, my dear fellow. Hmm? And please correct me, Miss Irvine, if I make any mistakes. Now, 3 days ago, Sir Edward Irvine, the father of this young lady, was found stabbed to death in his study.
Oh, gracious, where? I'm sorry to hear that.
The only entrance to the study is through an anteroom, where his secretary had been sitting ever since Sir Edward was last seen alive. And the secretary swore that no one had entered or left the study. The
secretary's name being Binion, I suppose.
Yes, under the circumstances, it's hard to see that any other arrest was possible.
And yet I know he's innocent, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, and how do you know that, Miss Irwin?
We were in love. We were going to be married. I don't care what the police say. A woman knows these things. Robert Binion did not kill my father.
Did your father approve of the engagement?
Well, no. Not exactly.
If one were to be exact, Miss Evin, wouldn't one say that your father absolutely forbade the marriage?
Yes, he did.
And Inspector Lestrade assumed that was the motive for the murder.
Well, sounds logical, I must say.
Does your father have any other relatives living, Miss Irvin?
His brother, my Uncle Peregrine. He lives a hermit's life in the country. We've seen very little of him in the last few years.
Was he left anything under your father's will?
No, I was the sole beneficiary. Please help me, Mr. Holmes. If you'll just talk to Robert, you'll know he's not guilty.
Oh, there's no harm in talking to him, Holmes. After all, our old friend Lestrade handled the case, and he's made a good many mistakes in the past.
Oh, you know. Haven't we all, old chap? Well, Miss Irvin, I'll do what I can, but I promise nothing.
Bless you, Mr. Holmes.
Where is your fiancé being held?
At Scotland Yard. I talked to him there just before I came to
you. Scotland Yard, eh? Splendid. We can talk to Lestrade at the same time. Watson, your hat...
My hat and coat?
Precisely, old fellow, your hat and coat.
So, Mr. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson think they know more than the Yard, eh? Come over here to teach us our business, I suppose.
Nothing of the sort, Lestrade. We came over here to make a few inquiries.
I tell you, gentlemen, that you're wasting your time. Young Binion is guilty, whatever his young lady may say.
Lestrade?
Yes, Mr. Holmes?
What did the autopsy prove?
Well, got a report of it here on my desk, but it won't tell you nothing you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Death was instantaneous, caused by some weapon like a long needle, a fine stiletto, or an ice pick, penetrating the brain at the base of the skull.
And no such weapon was found in the room.
Or on Mr. Binion.
True, sir. But then he had the chance of disposing of it.
Just the same, the murder weapon hasn't been found, has it?
No, Doctor, but we'll find it. Don't you worry about that.
I should like to talk to the prisoner, if you don't mind.
Well, of course I don't mind. He's in the detention cell just down the corridors from here. Follow me, gentlemen.
Has he given you any trouble, Lestrade?
Trouble? If all our prisoners were as quiet as him, we wouldn't need no guards, Doctor. Nice, quiet young fellow. Hard to realize he's a murderer.
A fact that still has to be proven in court, Lestrade.
A fact that is going to be proved in court, Mr. Holmes. Well, here we are at his cell. You've got visitors, Binion. Very distinguished visitors.
Who are you, gentlemen?
My name is Holmes, Sherlock Holmes, and this is my colleague, Dr. Watson.
I'm sorry to see you in this plight, Mr. Binion.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes, then Harriet did come and see you when she left here. I'm so glad. You'll get me out of this mess. I know you will.
Even Mr. Sherlock Holmes can't get you out of this one, young fellow.
Mr. Binion, I promised your fiancée that I'd try and help you. My obvious course is to go to Sir Edward's house and examine the room in which the tragedy occurred. But before I do that, I'd like to ask you a question or two.
Ask me any question you want to, sir.
It was you who discovered the body, I understand.
Yes, Mr. Holmes.
Please describe the circumstances.
Sir Edward was in his study. I had been working in the anteroom adjoining. At 5 o'clock, I went in to say goodnight to him, and I found him slumped in his chair, dead, with blood streaming down the back of his head. Of course, I sent the butler for the police at once.
Could anyone have entered that room without your knowledge?
No, Mr. Holmes. I never left my desk. And there was no other entrance to the room save through my office.
Well, how about the windows in Sir Edward's room?
They were locked from the inside, Doctor.
Oh, you don't need to worry. We examined the window ledges, not a mark. No one came in that way.
Now, what is your theory of the murder, Mr. Binion?
I haven't one, Mr. Holmes. I'm completely baffled. I'm certain that no one entered that room. Yet I swear to you that I didn't stab him. Though I can understand the police believing I did.
Mm-hmm. Lestrade, I should like to examine the room in which Sir Edward was murdered.
Well, easiest thing in the world, Mr. Holmes. I'll drive over with you if you like. His house is in Knightsbridge.
Oh, you needn't bother, Lestrade. We can quite well go by ourselves.
Oh, not a bit of it, Doctor. I'd like to come with you.
Oh, why, Lestrade? You're convinced that Mr. Binion is guilty, are you? Won't you be wasting your time?
Not me. For once I know you're on the wrong side of a case, Mr. Holmes. And I want to be there and see your faces when you find it out. This is the house, Mr. Holmes.
Yes, an imposing-looking place, I must say. I imagine, Lestrade, that you still have a police guard inside.
Oh, yes, Doctor. There's been a sergeant guarding the dead man's room day and night. We still haven't found the missing weapon, you know.
Yes, gentlemen.
I'm Inspector Lestrade of Scotland Yard. We wish to examine the house.
I must see your identification, sir.
What are you talking about? I've been in and out of this house half a dozen times.
I have my orders, sir.
Oh, very well.
Is Miss Irvine at home?
Miss Irvine is not receiving, sir.
Great Scott, man, can't you give us any information?
There's been tragedy in this house, sir, and the truth of it's not known yet. I'm not answering any questions that I don't have to.
Yeah. There now. Does this police guard satisfy you?
Inspector Lestrade. Very good, Inspector. You may come in. May I direct you, gentlemen?
No, thank you. I know this house nearly as well as you do.
I think not, Inspector. I've served here for 27 years. Well, gentlemen, if you're not needing me, I'll return to my quarters.
Bless my soul. That's a sinister-looking chap if I ever saw one.
Yes, and he knows something. You see, Lestrade, there is a possibility that Binion is innocent.
Yes, I began to see that, sir, when you were talking to the butler.
You're being very cryptic. What other possibility are you talking about?
The possibility that Binion... is that Binion, the arrested man, is shielding the real murderer. And whom would he be most certain to shield?
You mean his fiancée, Miss Irvine?
That's right, old fellow.
What?
Here we are. This is the ante room where young Binion worked. And that door there leads into the study where Sir Edward was found.
Nothing been touched, of course, since the discovery of the crime?
Oh, no, Mr. Holmes. That's why we've had a constable on duty in there night and day. Before the trial, we're bringing experts in to test the room for secret panels or anything of that kind.
Let's examine the dead man's room, shall we?
Right you are, Mr. Holmes. Webster. Webster, get out of that chair and stand up, can't you? You're on duty.
Must be asleep. Great Scott, he's dead.
Yes. With a trickle of blood oozing out from the base of his skull.
Well, strike me pink. He's been killed the same way as Sir Edward was.
I presume you'll agree that Mr. Binion didn't commit this murder, Lestrade.
Well, of course not, Mr. Holmes. He couldn't have done it. He's locked up at the yard. Well, what are we going to do?
Ask the butler to come here, will you?
Right you are, sir. What do you make of their wound, Doctor?
Well, it fit the description of the one that killed Sir Edward. There's a fine puncture here at the base of the skull. By Jove, Holmes, they mentioned a stiletto or an ice pick. A wound like this might be caused by one of those long steel hatpins that women wear.
Yes, it's a possibility, Watson, a distinct possibility. And Miss Irvine was wearing a long hatpin this morning, if you remember. Plastered walls. No little chance of secret panels here, I should say.
And the window's locked from the inside, eh?
Yeah. Here he is, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, yes, and by the way, what's your name?
Travers, sir.
You see what's happened, Travers?
Yes, sir, I see. The constable's been killed just like my master.
Now, tell me, Travers, is this room exactly as it was in Sir Edward's lifetime?
Yes, sir. Except that my master was not in the habit of keeping the corpses of policemen in here.
Don't try to be funny, Travers. Don't you realize you're mixed up in a murder case?
I meant no offense, gentlemen.
Marks in bad taste, my good fellow.
The point of my question, Travers, was to find out if any of the furniture in here had been moved lately.
Not moved, sir. But there has been a piece of furniture added. That armchair the dead man's lying in.
The same chair in which Sir Edward's body was found. Of course that's the answer. Travers, when was that chair delivered, and who delivered it?
It was delivered the day before Sir Edward died. It came from Silber Schwartz's antique shop in Bond Street,
uh-huh.
Sir.
That game's afoot, Lestrade. See to the removal of this poor man's body. Seal the room, and for heaven's sake, keep this latest death a secret for a day at least. Within that time, I hope to have your murderer for you.
Then we're going...
We're going, my dear chap, to Silber Schwartz's antique shop in Bond Street.
Those old music boxes are quite charming, Holmes, aren't they?
Yes, but where's Mr. Silberschwanz? Oh,
this is probably him. What a funny-looking old fellow.
Oh, Mr. Silberschwanz.
Yes, gentlemen. You are interested in musical boxes?
No, sir, in chairs. Particularly in the handsomely carved chair you delivered to Sir Edward Irvine a few days ago.
Ah, yeah, a magnificent specimen. He's pleased with it?
He was found dead in it, Mr. Silberschwanz.
And half an hour ago, someone else was found dead in it also. That chair was one of a pair, wasn't it?
Yeah. Holy forgotten Himmel. That's impossible. Please to follow me. I assure you it's not possible. Look at the chair.
Looks exactly like the same one as Sir Edward's house.
Oh, my friend, but there's such a difference.
15th century Italian, isn't it?
Yeah, this is one of a pair of the famous Malipiero armchairs. There are only three pairs in the world, my friends. Of this pair, one, the one I delivered to Sir Edward, is simply a great specimen of the carver's art. This one, its mate, looks exactly like it, does it not?
Exactly. I can't see any difference, myself.
You would if you sat in it, old chap.
Precisely. That is why I have these cords stretched from one arm of the chair to the other. If anyone were to sit in it well, sometimes nothing will happen. But sooner or later, a hand will press on this hidden spring in the arm here, and death will strike.
But nothing happened when you pressed the spring then, Mr. Silverstones?
No, I don't understand.
I do. This is the harmless chair. The lethal one was sent to Sir Edward. He sat in it, accidentally pressed the spring and drove the fatal needle into his brain.
Just as that poor constable did today.
Sir Edward bought both chairs, I presume?
Yeah, I would not sell the pair separately.
Then why didn't you deliver both at the same time?
He was afraid of the deadly one. Huh? He asked me to keep it here until he found a safe place for it in his home.
Mm-hmm. And some devil switched the arm cord from the fatal chair to the harmless one so that you delivered death to Sir Edward. There is a subtlety in this crime worthy of the fiendish maker of the chairs himself. Silber Schwartz.
Yeah, mein Herr.
Didn't Malapieri die of being tricked into seating himself in one of his own chairs?
Yeah, he did.
Ah, poetic justice. I'm much obliged to you, Silber Schwartz. Now I think I know how to trap our killer.
Dr. Watson will bring you the rest of his story in just a second, so I'm just going to tell you that after a good dinner, there's nothing quite like a glass of good Petri California Port. Petri Port is really a wonderful wine. A deep, hearty red in color and rich and truly delicious in flavor. You know, port wine is actually America's favorite wine. Try a glass of Petri Port and you'll know why. Petri Port is not only fine after dinner, it's perfect whenever good friends get together. Just keep in mind the name Petri, because Petri wines are good wines. Well, Dr. Watson, this is quite a story you're telling us tonight. So you found out how the murders had been committed, but not who'd been responsible for it.
That's quite right, Mr. Bartell. Holmes spent a long time cross-examining Mr. Silverschwanz, the owner of the antique store, as to who might have had the opportunity of switching the telltale cord from the fatal chair.
And who did have that opportunity,
well,
Doctor?
Well, Mr. Bartell, it transpires that four people might have been responsible. Sir Edward's daughter, the secretary, Mr. Binion, had both been in the shop with him at various times. So had the butler, Trevor's. The fourth suspect was Sir Edward's eccentric brother, Peregrine, who it appeared had dropped into the shop the day after the purchase had been made. With this last information, Holmes became very excited and launched into eager preparations, which ended a few hours later when we found ourselves disguised as furniture removers, driving a van along a quiet country lane near Dorking as we approached the house of Sir Edward's brother, Peregrine.
There's the house, Watson. Ramshackle-looking place, isn't it?
Yes, extremely so.
Why are you so morose, my dear chap? You've hardly spoken a word on our drive down here.
You never told me anything. Why are we trundling off into the wilds of the country disguised as furniture removers carrying the harmless chair with us.
Surely the reason is transparent, old chap?
It's just about as transparent as golf stocking full of hot tripe.
Oh, my dear Watson, surely it's obvious that we're up against an extremely cunning murderer. Now, what advantage accrues to him in using the Malapiero chair?
An alibi, of course. He's nowhere near the place where the murder happens.
Precisely. Apply your logic a little further. Three of the suspects, the daughter, Mr. Binion, and Travers, the butler, live in the house and would almost certainly have been present at the time of death. Therefore, who gains most by such an alibi?
Well, the brother, Peregrine.
Elementary, my dear Watson. Now you see why we trundled off into the wilds of Dorking.
Well, that must be Peregrine standing up at the porch. He's a funny-looking fella.
Follow my lead, Watson.
Good afternoon, Governor.
You fellows must have come to the wrong house.
You were Mr. Peregrine Irvine, ain't you, Governor?
Yes.
And we come to the right house. All right, all right, all right. Come on, Bertie, give us a hand.
Right you are, Alfie.
What the devil are you unloading an armchair?
Go on, get out of there, Charlie. You drop it on my foot, Bertie, look at. Easy does it. Come on, Bert. That's
right. I got it, Alf. I got it.
All right. Let her down easy now on the porch here.
There you go. That's it.
Jiminy crickets. Ain't that a pretty chair, Governor? Bertie and me was admiring it on our way down here.
Cool, blimey. Isn't off a nice chair?
But who told you to bring it here?
Orders, Governor. Mr. Silver Snitch. Whatever his name is. Tell us your brother didn't want the chair and said as how we was to bring it to you.
But my brother's dead.
Mr. Silver Snitch said he gave the order before he died. Mind if I sit down in it, Governor?
Well, of course not, of course not.
Cool, lummy. Bit of all right, isn't it?
Look at him laughing.
Go wish me old Trouble and Strife could see me now.
Trouble and Strife?
Yeah. Trouble and Strife, that's me wife, Governor. Here, sit down yourself, sir. Come on, go on, sit down, try it. Go on, Governor. Take the weight off your plates of meat.
What barbaric jargon do you speak? What on earth are plates of meat?
Plates of meat is feet, Governor. That's rhyming slang.
That's right. Rhyming slang. Go on, sit down in it. Go on.
All right, very well.
There now. Ain't that comfortable?
Yeah, very.
Go on. Run your hands over the arms, Governor. Ain't that carving pretty? Ain't it just ducky?
Yes. Yes, it is. But I don't want the wretched thing. There's been some mistake. So you'd better take it back to London and tell them to sell it. I don't want anything of my brother's.
Jumping Jehoshaphat. Can't you see why you don't want to sit... Can't see why you don't want to sit in a nice chair like this, Governor? But you're the one that gives the orders around here. Come on, Bertie. Come on, get your bag into it.
All right, Alfie.
Let's get back in the van. All right, come on.
Away they go.
Oh, bless your heart, Governor. We don't worry about that sort of thing, do we, Bertie? Of
course not, Alfie. We'd had a nice drive in the country anyhow, didn't we?
That's right. Let's get these old horses going. Good day, Governor.
Good day,
Governor. Good. That was a false trail, Holmes. Obviously, he knew nothing about the chair. He thought it was perfectly harmless.
And, as indeed it was. But the murderer would have thought it fatal. I've slipped up in my reasoning somehow. Confound.
Oh, but of course! Oh, what a fool I am! We must get back to London as fast as these tired nags can take us. Come on, get up there! Get up!
What's the next move, Holmes?
Back to Sir Edward's house and the staging of a little drama that I'm sure will give us the final answer to this problem. Arrangements, Lestrade?
Yes, Mr. Holmes. I've got Miss Irvine, young Binion, and the butler waiting outside. And no one knows we switched the chairs.
Splendid.
Well, you're sure that this is the harmless chair,
yes,
Holmes?
Of course I am. Look here. I sit in it. So, run my hands over the arms. Yes, this chair is harmless, as every person save one will know. Show them in, Lestrade.
All at once, Mr. Holmes?
No, I think we'll take Miss Irvine and Mr. Binion first.
Well, right you are, sir. Miss Irvine, Mr. Binion, come in, please.
Yes, sir.
Very well. Oh, Mr. Holmes.
What's the matter, Miss Irvine?
It's just so horrible seeing you there in the same chair where I saw Father.
Oh.
Mr. Holmes, it's a trifle too macabre for you to assume the position of the corpse. Please get up.
But it seems to be the most comfortable chair in the room, and I do like my comfort when I interrogate witnesses. However, it's hardly chivalrous, is it? Miss Irvine, please sit down, won't you?
I don't like to sit down in the chair in which Father died.
Oh, Miss Irvine, we couldn't bear to see you standing.
Very well, then.
Don't sit down, Harry.
Why not, Binion? What's the matter? Isn't the chair safe?
No, it's
then
not
perhaps
that
you care to sit in it. To prove that the chair is safe.
No, I...
Sit down!
Very well. There.
Splendid. It's a curious chair, isn't it, Mr. Binion? I wonder about these carvings on the arms. They look almost as if they might activate concealed springs. I wonder what would happen if I...
No, for heaven's sakes, Mr. Holmes, you're trying to kill me.
Kill you? Then you know how Sir Edward and the policeman were murdered, eh?
I knew it must have something to do with the chair.
You knew more than that, Robert. You planned it. I remember now that when we went to the shop,
Be quiet, Harry!
Come that way, you!
Robert!
No, Watson, don't go after them. Lestrade will stop him. In any case, the police are at the door. Oh, I'm tired. I think I'll sit in this rather fateful armchair.
So it was young Binion all the time, eh?
Yes, and he all but outsmarted me. I reasoned that somehow the murderer must have intended the device of this chair to clear him. And suddenly I saw the real motivation. How better establish his innocence than seeming to be obviously guilty and yet leaving a trail whereby an astute deduction could seem to clear him.
Yes, it was his idea that Miss Irvin came to you. He used you as a cat's paw.
That's right, Watson. I'm afraid this whole case is a rather humiliating experience for me.
Well, why do you say that?
Lestrade had arrested the right man in the first place. Oh, ho, ho. Oh, my dear Watson, I shall never hear the end of this. Never.
As usual, Doctor, that was a swell story. Imagine Lestrade accidentally arresting the right man.
Well, he had that one coming to him. Poor fellow, he'd been outwitted by Holmes so many times, he was beginning to get an inferiority complex.
What about Miss Irvin? How did she take it when her boyfriend Binion had proved guilty?
Well, when she realized that her sweetheart had actually murdered her father, as they say in the penny thrillers, her love turned to hate. But at first, she took it pretty badly.
I can imagine so.
Mr. Bartell, my boy, that's one of the disadvantages of being a detective. When you bring the guilty to justice, you very often cause the innocent to suffer too. Believe me, never become a detective. Stick to being a wine expert.
You calling me a wine expert? Oh. Now, wait a minute, Doctor. All I know about wine is that it either tastes good or it doesn't. And I know that Petri wine always does taste good. And I know why, too. It's because the Petri family has been making wine for generations. The art of turning luscious, sun-ripened grapes into fragrant, delicious wine is their heritage. A heritage handed down within the Petri family from father to son, from father to son. What particular type wine you prefer is, of course, a matter of your personal taste. But let me assure you of this. Whatever type wine you desire, for any occasion, you can depend on any wine that bears the Petri label. Petri took time to bring you good wine. And today, that name Petri is the proudest name in the long history of America's wines. Well, Dr. Watson, what new Sherlock Holmes adventure are you planning to tell us next week?
Next week, Mr. Bartell. Now, let me see. Next week, I'm going to tell you a strange story that took place in one of the smaller states of Middle Europe. It concerns a young prince, a most unusual concert, and a beautiful contralto who sang 2 days after we'd seen her die at the hands of the firing squad. I call the story The Haunting of Sherlock Holmes.
Doctor, that's one I've got to listen to.
Yes, Mr. Bartell. And everyone should also listen to what Secretary of Agriculture Anderson says about saving used kitchen fats. We've all got to keep turning in every bit of used fat. Take it to your meat dealer. The shortage of fats is worse now than ever it was. And unless we help, and we all help, we'll all be faced with a serious shortage of soap. Yes, and a serious shortage of paints, lubricating oils, drugs, and many other things that require fats in their manufacture. It's up to us. Keep turning in every bit of used kitchen fat.
Tonight's Sherlock Holmes adventure was written by Dennis Green and Anthony Boucher and was suggested by an incident in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's story, The Musgrove Ritual. Music is by Dean Faltzler. Mr. Rathbone appears through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Mr. Bruce through the courtesy of Universal Pictures, where they are now starring in the Sherlock Holmes series. The Petri Wine Company of San Francisco, California,
invite you to tune in again next week, same time, same station. Sherlock Holmes comes to you from our Hollywood studio. This is Harry Bartell saying goodnight for the Petrie family. For a solid hour of exciting mystery dramas, listen every Monday on most of these same stations at 8 o'clock to Michael Shane, followed immediately by Sherlock Holmes. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Indeed it was, the Mutual Broadcasting System, back when they did old-time radio, Sherlock Holmes and the Uneasy Easy Chair. And that can be heard at 6 a.m. and p.m. Eastern Time on the Radio Theater Channel. Now we're going to dip into something else on the schedule, The Whistler and Still Death, from September 22nd, 1948.
And now for the Signal Oil program, The Whistler, the mystery program that is unique among all mystery programs.
Because you know who's guilty.
You see his every move.
You know his complete plans, even his innermost thoughts.
Yet the final curtain always brings a startling surprise. In the Signal Oil program, The Whistler. That whistle is your signal for the Signal Oil program, The Whistler.
I am The Whistler, and I know many things, for I walk by night. I know many strange tales hidden in the hearts of men and women who have stepped into the shadows. Yes, I know the nameless terrors of which they dare not speak.
Yes, friends, it's The Whistler for the tops in entertainment. And for the tops in gasoline quality, it's Signal. It takes extra quality, you know, to give you extra mileage. And Signal is the famous Go Farther gasoline. So look for the Signal circle sign in yellow and black that identifies friendly independent Signal stations from Canada to Mexico. And now the Whistler's strange story. Still Death.
Even with the moonlight through the big window, the studio room seemed dark to him as he let himself in quickly and leaned back against the door. It was like moving in a nightmare somehow. Everything vague, out of focus. He didn't know how long he'd been standing there when it came. That soft knock on the door. He didn't even hear it at first. Didn't respond. Until it was repeated urgently, demandingly. Then he came out of his daze sufficiently to hurry across the studio to the easel by the window. Quickly he removed the painting, slipped it behind a desk. Then he turned to answer the door. The man facing him was a total stranger, but he called him by name.
Leonard Miles?
That's right.
You're standing in the dark, Mr. Miles.
Well, I was just leaving.
Sure. You mind if I come in?
What do you want?
Like to take a look around.
Now, look, it's late. My studio's closed.
You know Ann Hamilton, Mr. Miles?
Ann Hamilton? No, I don't.
Funny. That's about the only answer I get out of this neighborhood. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Miles. I'm Lieutenant Meehan. Homicide.
Homicide?
You mind putting on the lights? Ah, that's better. Well, you've worked on some interesting subjects, Mr. Miles.
What is it, Lieutenant? What's on your mind?
Your work, Mr. Miles. Your paintings. I'd like to look at them. They're all that I've had on my mind since learning about Ann Hamilton. In case you didn't know, she's dead.
You just stand there, don't you, Leonard? Facing the police lieutenant. Not even hearing your own voice as you tell him to go ahead and examine the canvases. You're almost not aware of him as he moves about the room. Because your mind is spinning rapidly. Going over it all again, reliving each week, day and hour that you spent with Ann Hamilton. the girl he's asking about. You'd like to tell him about it, tell him the kind of person she was, but you don't. Because there's still Mary to think about. There's always been Mary. Before Anne, before everything, there's always been Mary, your wife. How well you remember the day you and Mary discussed the exhibition.
Feel better now?
Delicious tea, Mary. Thanks so much.
Oh, not at all, Connie. So good of you to pose for Leonard.
Oh, I love it. He's taught me more in these past weeks than a semester of art school. You going to work any more this afternoon, Mr. Miles?
No, Connie, that'll be all for the day.
Oh, I'll be running on then. Got a class tonight.
You pay heed to this young lady, Mary. She'll graduate from that art school in a year or so and run me out of business.
Oh, in a year you'll be so famous no one will buy from anyone else. Good night, Mary. Mr. Miles.
Good night, Connie.
Good night, Connie.
She's a wonderful girl.
Yes.
You know, Leonard, sometimes I wonder why you stay with me.
Oh, please, Mary.
No. I'm not a help to you. It's a struggle for an artist anyway, and with an invalid wife.
Now, stop it, Mary. You help me more than you'll ever know. It's just that, well, I wish I could do more for you, take you away somewhere, let you live in the kind of place that you should.
I'm happy with you, Leonard.
Mary, I was offered that job again.
No, Leonard.
There's really nothing wrong with doing magazine illustrations, and it means money. We could try to save...
It isn't what you want to do. You know that. What about the exhibit? You haven't completed your work.
The exhibit isn't going to mean anything. Never has.
Perhaps it will this time. Let's wait and see. I have a feeling about it, Leonard. Promise me you'll wait until after the exhibit. Please, Leonard.
All right, Mary, darling. I promise.
Yes, Leonard, your wife Mary had a feeling that the art exhibit was going to make a difference. But it wasn't really different from the others before it. You still heard the same remarks as you moved about among the little group of onlookers. Then they were gone, the curious, the mocking, and the few real patrons. You're alone now, standing there, looking around at a room full of paintings, paintings that no one wanted to buy. You stare at one you were certain they would like, the girl's face with that curious light across it. Then you're startled suddenly at the sound of a girl's voice.
Hello.
You almost believe your mind is playing tricks, and then she speaks again.
Hello.
Why, hello.
I didn't mean to startle you.
I thought everyone had gone.
Yes. I waited until they had. I like your work, Mr. Miles.
Oh?
I like it very much. I may like it well enough to buy.
Well, everything you see is for sale, Miss...
Hamilton. Anne Hamilton.
Yes. Well, was there something in particular?
I'd like some time to study them.
Well, the exhibit's over, but these will all be brought back to my studio.
I suppose I could come over there. That is, if the transaction can be kept private.
Private?
I wouldn't want any talk, Mr. Miles.
Well, I'm sure the mere fact of your buying a picture wouldn't concern
most... It might concern some people. You're a very attractive man, Mr. Miles.
I trust my wife finds me so.
I'm sure she does. My car is across the street. I wonder if we could continue this over a cocktail.
Why,
I know. You're expected home. Couldn't you make a call? It's business, Mr. Miles.
Yes, I can call. I'll do it right away. Look, Miss Hamilton, about the paintings...
You said you'd call me Anne.
All right, Anne. What about the...
The painting, yes.
Is it the girl, the one I was looking at
the
when
girl?
You...
The girl? No, Leonard, I wouldn't want that. Someone else posed for you. No. Leonard, I want you to paint me.
Oh?
Will you do it?
Well, naturally, portrait painting is my business.
Good. But I should warn you, I'm going to want something unusual. I'd like a painting of myself just as I am, Leonard. No pretty lights or shadows. No painting out the lines.
That should be easy. And there aren't any lines.
You noticed, didn't you? You've noticed a lot about me.
Why, yes, of course. I make a habit of studying subjects.
You're perfect for what I want, Leonard. You'll paint me exactly as I am.
Well, I'll try, Anne. And it isn't such an unusual request.
No. Leonard, someone once told me that I should be painted killing someone or something. You don't believe that, do you?
Well, I don't know.
But you'll paint me.
Well, yes.
Just as I am. We'll work together until it's exactly like me.
Yes, Anne. Until it's exactly like you.
With the prologue of Still Death, the Signal Oil Company brings you another strange story by The Whistler. But now two announcements of unusual importance to all contract bridge players. One, the first changes in the rules of contract bridge since 1941 were just made on the first of this month at the Culbertson Teachers Convention. And two, a copy of all these new bridge rules is already waiting for you at your nearest Signal service station. Yes, that's right. The only new developments in bridge in the last 7 years have now been boiled down into convenient, easy-to-understand form by Signal's own bridge expert, Robert Lee Johnson. These are completely separate from the 6 lessons in contract bridge now being distributed by Signal dealers. So whether you're collecting these Signal bridge lessons or not, if you play contract bridge at all, you'll want this handy summary of the new rules in contract bridge. Naturally, it's yours for the asking. And the place to ask for it is at your friendly neighborhood Signal dealer. Friends, before returning to the Whistler, here is an important announcement for Whistler fans in California only. Next Wednesday, the Whistler will be heard in California 1 hour later at 8:30 p.m. Remember, this is in California only. And now back to the Whistler.
It was like a nightmare, wasn't it, Leonard? From the moment you met Anne Hamilton there in the empty art gallery, the way she seemed to step out of the shadows into your life. From the first, there was something that told you to stay away from her, to turn and run, but you didn't. And the following evening, you made excuses to Mary, left her in the apartment, walked down the long corridor and across the patio to the room that served as your studio, stood in the half-darkness smoking a cigarette while you waited. That deep urge to call it all off is there again for an instant, isn't it, Leonard? And then it's all swept away, and you're over the brink as you find yourself with Anne.
Oh, Leonard, it's just as I thought it would be, your studio. It's as if I'd been here many times before. Leonard?
Yes?
Does your wife like to come here?
Well, unfortunately, my wife can't come here. She's an invalid.
Oh?
She was in an accident.
That's too bad.
She used to come here all the time before she was hurt, but she's still very interested in my work.
So am I. Can we start our painting tonight?
Well, Anne, you wanted to come here to see the studio, but I wouldn't recommend working this way. At night, I mean. The light's all wrong.
You'd rather I came in the daytime?
Anne, I don't get all this secrecy. There's no reason that you shouldn't come here any time. I'm a professional artist, and many women have their portraits
painted.
But
that's just it. You see, I want this painting to be a surprise.
Oh.
If anyone knew I was seeing you, it might get into the papers.
The papers?
You don't understand, do you? But then I don't think you're really trying to. Oh, nothing to worry about. I'm not front page copy. But I am a society column item.
Look, Anne, now that you've seen the place...
You're nervous, aren't you? I make you nervous.
Well...
It's all right, we'll go. I don't want to rush things, Leonard. I don't ever want you to do anything with me that you don't want to do.
Look,
Lower your left arm a little, will you?
Like this?
No, a little more. Now, that's it.
Why don't you let me talk?
Not while you're posing.
But, Leonard, I want to talk.
Please, Anne, I can't concentrate on what I'm doing.
Do I affect you that way? I want to.
Please.
It's been a week. When can I see what you've done?
Well, when I'm finished. I want you to get the total effect.
Oh. Well, I want to see you. Dinner tonight?
I can't make it tonight.
Oh, but you must. It's about someone I know. A woman who wants a portrait of her daughter.
Oh? Oh, can't she see me here?
No. No, I want to talk to you about it. Tell you what to say. Please?
All right, Anne. Tonight, then. Dinner.
Why are you stopping?
Anne, this whole thing has to stop somewhere. I want to talk to you.
I know. It's about Mary.
Yes, it is.
I was hoping you meant that everything is over between you two, and you've told her.
That isn't what I mean.
I've been giving it a lot of thought. You know, it isn't going to be easy, Leonard. The divorce. Being an invalid will put the sympathy of the court on Mary's side.
And...
But we'll work it out, won't we, darling?
Well, I don't know. A man just
You
can't...
want us to be together, don't you?
Well, when I'm with you, I do. But, Anne, I've got to have time to think.
Certainly, dear. I love you. You know that. But I don't want to wait forever. And I know you don't either.
Anne, if there was no one else to consider, if Mary wasn't...
Kiss me, darling.
Well, I...
It's going to be all right.
Connie, what are you doing in the studio?
Oh, just wanted to say hello. I stopped in on Mary this morning.
Well, I'm sorry, Connie, but this work I'm doing is...
I peeked under the cover.
You what?
You haven't finished the face. Is she very beautiful?
I didn't want anybody to see it. Connie, you had no right.
No, I suppose not. But it made me think of something. How beautiful Mary is, even now.
Thank you, Connie. What?
Mary.
Mary, you shouldn't be standing.
I wanted to surprise you, Leonard. I walked part of the way. Look.
Oh, darling, you'll fall. Here. Bring the wheelchair, Connie.
I'm sorry, Leonard. I tried anyway.
Here now. Easy now. There.
Thanks, darling.
Oh, Mary.
I'll get it, Mr. Miles.
No, Connie, I'll get it. Take Mary back to the apartment, will you, please?
Whatever you say.
Hello?
Hello, darling.
I can't talk to you now.
What is it, darling?
Never mind. You needn't come here today. It's all finished.
The painting?
Everything.
Oh. Well, whatever you want, darling. But I must see you once more.
No, Anne, it's over. I know for the first time in weeks. I'm sure now.
Tonight at my home, you know the address.
Anne, I'm not
just
going...
Just this once. I'll be expecting you, darling. 8 o'clock.
Now, what is it, Anne? I told you I didn't want to come here.
Please, darling, don't be upset. Come along. I want you to meet someone. In here.
What's that?
I'll put on the light. There. And now let me introduce you to the man who has given me everything money can buy. My dear, devoted husband.
Your husband?
Now you know why I couldn't be seen with you.
Anne, he's in pain.
Yes, poor darling. He had a stroke just last month. But he won't suffer long.
You've talked like this in front of him?
He can hear me. Yes. But he can't speak or move.
I'm going to do something, Anne. I'm going to call
a doctor. Don't bother. He has the best doctors and a fine nurse. She'll be back in a little while. Besides, darling, you wouldn't want Mary to know about us, would you? She's an invalid, too, in the shock.
No, no, I never want Mary to know about us. All right, Anne. What do you want from me?
I want you to finish that painting. It was my husband here who suggested I should be painted killing something.
I see.
I thought you would. Let's adjourn to the library, shall we? Good night, dear. You are going to paint me now, aren't you?
Yes, Anne. I'm going to paint you now.
My arm, let go.
Sit down. Now, give me that purse. I'll paint you now. Now.
My ear. Let go.
Rouge, lots of it, smeared on both cheeks. A little purple for the eyelids. Lots of purple. And red, deep blood red for the lips. A straight red gash. This is the painting for you. Go on. Look at yourself in the mirror. Take a good look.
All right, Leonard. Do it this way. I'll still be at your studio tomorrow. You can finish it. And then I'll finish with you.
You wait anxiously all the next day. Near evening, you go to the uncompleted painting, stare at it, suddenly take a brush and start to work. Slowly at first, and then rapidly until you complete it. Yes, this is Anne, isn't it? The way you see her. Then as you set aside your brush, you're aware of her presence.
It's beautiful, Leonard.
It's the way you are, Anne. Why, Anne, you're hurt.
Yes. I've been shot.
Shot?
Funny. Very funny. I didn't think it would be this way. But I told you I'd finish things for us, Leonard. And I will. And the police arrive. Find me here. Dying in your arms.
Whistler will return in just a moment with a strange ending to tonight's story. Meantime, a special word to you folks who did some traveling throughout the Pacific Coast states this summer. In addition to interesting scenery, you no doubt noticed two other things. One, that wherever you drove, you found friendly Signal dealers. And two, that from Canada to Mexico, Signal gasoline is known as the Go Farther gasoline. Now, naturally, we're plenty proud of Signal's good mileage. But even more so, we're proud of what makes that mileage possible. I'm talking about the extra efficiency today's Signal gasoline coaxes from your motor, which naturally means more thrilling pickup, more silent responsive power for your car. Extra performance, you see, goes hand in hand with mileage, the very thing Signal gasoline is famous for. That's why we say, to be sure of the tops in gasoline quality, there are just two things to remember. One, it takes extra quality to go farther. And two, Signal is the famous Go Farther gasoline. And now back to the Whistler.
It's a terrible moment, isn't it, Leonard? The climax of a nightmare. As you hold the dying Anne Hamilton in your arms, a thousand confused thoughts crowd into your mind. You can't understand what's happened.
Anne, who did this? Who shot? Where did you get that gun?
I guess my husband wasn't as much of an invalid as I thought.
Your husband?
Yes. I I shot him. And then when I put the gun in his hand, make it look like suicide, he shot me.
Oh, no, Anne.
And I saw the suicide angle wouldn't work. I brought the gun up here to pin the whole thing on you, darling.
Quickly, you pick her up, carry her down the back way, and then bring her car around. Moments later, you're racing toward the nearest hospital. Anne, slumped in the seat beside you, continues to mumble incoherently. Then she's silent. On a darkened side street, you stop the car, walk around the corner to a drugstore, and slip into a phone booth.
Police Department. Sergeant Donald. Hello?
There's a blue convertible parked on Shell Street off Kelton. You'll find a woman in the front seat. She's dead.
Who is this? Hello? Who is this?
Ten minutes later, you're back at the studio, alone, exhausted, leaning weakly against the door. You're in the clear now, aren't you, Leonard? Certain the police won't be able to connect you with the deaths of Anne Hamilton and her husband. And most important, your wife, Mary, will never know about Anne. Yes, that's the most important thing in your life, isn't it? Mary. Her happiness now and always. For a long while, you stood there in the dark studio. Then the knock came. The soft knock on the door that brought Lieutenant Meehan of homicide. The quiet questions about Anne that sent your mind spinning as you watched the lieutenant move about the studio examining each candidate.
We traced her to this building. Officer Farrell gave her a ticket earlier this evening for going through a red light. Her car was weaving, so he followed her here. Then when he heard over the police radio that we were looking for Anne Hamilton, he called us.
You were looking for her?
Yeah. You see, she called headquarters an hour or so ago. Said someone had killed her husband. Said she thought the killer might be a man who had been painting her portrait. Didn't say who he was. But then when she came to this building, well, you're the only artist around here. See what I mean?
I don't know any Anne Hamilton, Lieutenant.
Mm-hmm. So he said before.
Have you finished looking around, Lieutenant?
Huh? Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Nice pictures. Well, thanks. I'll be on my way.
What's the matter?
I almost overlooked one of your paintings, Mr. Miles. This one behind the desk. Interesting work, Mr. Miles.
You like it?
I said it was interesting. You know, Miles, it's lucky for you I didn't find a portrait of Anne Hamilton here. I never can figure out you guys. Now take this canvas. You paint a beautiful dame with a figure like that. Then instead of a face, you top it off with a death's head.
Let that whistle be your signal for the Signal Oil program, The Whistler. Friends, let me repeat. Here is an important announcement for Whistler fans in California only. Next Wednesday, The Whistler will be heard in California 1 hour later at 8:30. Remember, this is California only. The Whistler is brought to you by the Signal Oil Company, marketers of Signal gasoline and motor oil and fine quality automotive accessories. Signal has asked me to remind you, to get the most driving pleasure, drive at sensible speeds, be courteous, and obey traffic regulations. It may save a life, possibly your own. Featured in tonight's story were William Conrad and Lorette Philbrand. The Whistler was produced and directed by George W. Allen, with story by Gilbert Thomas, and music by Wilbur Hatch. and was transmitted to our troops overseas by the Armed Forces Radio Service. Remember, at the same time next Wednesday, another strange tale by The Whistler. Marvin Miller speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The next two shows we'll listen to are 15-minute shows, approximately, and they are comedy. It's called Vic and Sade, and they're heard on the weekday schedule here from the Radio Theater Channel, just about the last thing you hear every night before we start the new day. So, a unique series, and we're going to give it a listen right now. We'll start off with Cork's Borrow a Cup of Sugar from 1945, and we'll continue right into The Unwanted Samaritan from 1945 as well.
Well, sir, it's late afternoon as our scene opens now, and here in the living room of a small house halfway up in the next block, we find Mr. and Mrs. Victor Good and their son, Mr. Rush Good. Vic and young Rush are newly arrived home from the office and Tatman's vacant lot, respectively, and as they remove their hats and overcoats, we hear the latter saying,
Bluetooth Johnson made the miserable assertion this afternoon that he was as good-looking as I was. His assertion provoked general laughter. Bluetooth Johnson is rotten-looking, and everybody knows it. I, on the other hand, am dandy-looking.
Here, Harriet, take my hat and coat in the hall and hang them up.
My fine looks are a great satisfaction to me.
There's a smudge of dirt on your chin.
Well, I'll fix that when I wash up for supper.
We're going to have a caller directly.
Yeah?
Miss Corkle is running over to borrow a cup of sugar.
Running over from where?
For home.
The 700 block on West Mulberry Street?
Yeah.
She's coming 20 blocks to borrow a cup of sugar.
Oh, Vic, she wants to be friendly. She likes you and me, and so does her husband, and they'd like to get on an intimate basis. I'm quite flattered.
Do you favor this arms around the neck idea?
I like Vernon and Edith.
So it's Vernon and Edith now, is it?
They're nice, fine, solid, substantial
people. Go ahead and consider yourself good-looking if you get any pleasure out of it. But please don't put yourself in the same class with me.
Who's he talking to?
I don't know, I'm sure.
I'm terrifically good-looking, I told him. He muttered some feeble remark and slunk off.
Who are you talking to, Ethel?
Oh, I'm just talking along.
The state provides free accommodations for folks who just talk alone.
You feel that I'm insane?
I feel that a certain party's little brains grow sluggish and the cerebrum leans up against the medulla oblongata in a tired, befuddled way.
Uh-huh.
No, I don't favor any arms around the neck stop with Mr. and Miss Corkle, but I enjoy their company occasionally. I wouldn't want to get established on the same intimate footing we got with Fred and Ruthie.
Kind of half-witted, isn't it, to come 20 blocks to borrow a cup of sugar?
Well, maybe, but at the same time, it's sweet.
The sugar?
Oh, go wipe off your chin, Rush.
Did you get down to my joke?
Yeah.
What's sweet, the sugar?
Take your joke outside and bury it. Quite a little distance from the house.
Okay.
Edith Corkle is a dandy, big, wholesome girl, and there's not a trace of meanness in her. And I think we ought to...
Mrs. Corkle?
Well, speak angels, and they spread their wings and fly right in the kitchen.
Hello there.
Vernon Corkle.
Yes, we're all in the living room, Mr. Corkle.
These people come and sit right in your lap.
They'd drop you like a red-hot poker if they thought you really thought that. They're both as sensitive as can be.
Mm.
I understand that wicked wife of mine is coming over to borrow a cup of sugar.
Yes.
Hello, Corkle.
Well, Mr. Gook, how are you?
Rich, popular, talented, handsome, neat, and roguish-eyed.
I can always count on a witty rejoinder from you, Mr. Gook.
Yes, indeed.
Your mind operates exactly like a steel trap.
Uh-huh.
Rush, I'm afraid I haven't said hello to you.
Hello.
Hello. That was silly.
Yes.
Mrs. Gook, I called Edith on the telephone a while ago, and she said she planned to run over here and borrow a cup of sugar. So I decided that as long as I was in the neighborhood, I'd join her, and then we could walk on back home together.
Yes.
And, of course, it's always a pleasure to see you people.
Mr. Corkle, wasn't you limping when you walked in just now?
Yes, Rush, I was. As a matter of fact, I had a little accident this afternoon. The garbage wagon horse stepped on my foot and gave it an awful squash.
Howard stepped on your foot?
Yes, the darn old horse. I believe he did it on purpose. I was standing in the alley there, passing the time of day with Mr. Gumpox, and Howard, the big smart aleck, pulled one of his front feet out of the mud and brought it down on my shoe with considerable force. See how it's all scuffed? And I bet my toes are black and blue.
There's somebody in the kitchen.
Howard is an evil-tempered horse and ought to be punished.
Hello.
Orville Weenie in the kitchen.
My brother-in-law in there?
Yes, Orville.
My whole family descending on you, Mr. Cook.
Well, it's perfectly all right.
My relatives are coming from all directions.
Oh, fine.
Hello, Orville.
Hello, Vernon.
Hello, Orville.
Hello.
I see you're still raising a pompadour.
Oh, I ain't having much luck with it. Tried everything on her I could think of, but she refused to lay down every trip. I tried water and kerosene and butter and soap and sewing machine oil and oyster stew and molasses on her, but she stays the way she is now. Man gets discouraged.
Uh-huh. Orville, I bet you telephoned Edith, too.
Yeah, I did. She said she was coming over here to borrow a cup of sugar.
I had a horse step on my foot this afternoon.
Yeah?
It isn't anything to laugh at, Orville. My toes are all black and blue, and it hurts me to walk.
Uh-huh.
Do you feel that it's comical when a horse injures a person's foot?
I feel it's comical if he injures your foot. I wouldn't feel it was comical if he injured my foot.
You won't be needed in this rush.
Tazzy, Tazzy in there.
Here's Mrs. Carcle.
Yes, we're all in the living room.
Are my bad husband and baby brother with you?
Yes, both of them.
This is my sister.
Uh-huh.
She must be close to 30 years old.
Yeah. Edith, honey.
Well, Mr. Husband.
Watch her pick him up.
Yeah?
Oh. Did he read lots of tiresome old gas meters today, though?
Hey, she's picking him up.
She's strong as a horse.
Hey, Mom, she's picking him up.
I'm standing right here.
Did he read lots of tiresome old gas meters today,
though? All right, Edith, put me down now.
I think you're getting heavier.
I think I am myself.
Mr. Cook, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Mrs. Corkle.
And Rush, honey?
Oh, I'm fine also.
How's my baby brother?
Hello. I was just wondering how old you were.
That's something I don't tell.
I imagine a man could figure it out.
Well, if Mrs. Corkle was born, say, in 1902, she'd be 43. She was born in 1915.
Rush, trot out in the kitchen and fetch a cup of sugar. Mrs. Corkle, I see you brought your own cup.
Yes. Here it is, Rush.
Oh, thanks.
A horse stepped on Vernon's foot today, Edith.
Yes. A darn horse stepped on my foot.
That's funny.
It hurt something fierce, Edith. Still does.
Where was it?
Out in the alley near University Avenue. I had paused to talk to Mr. Gumpox, the garbage man, and this rotten horse deliberately gave my foot an awful squash with his darn old hoof.
Well, when we get home, we'll put some salve on it.
I know the flesh is all black and blue.
You keep well, do you, Mr. Goat?
Well, I haven't been stepped on by any horse.
Well, if it had been Edith the horse stepped on, Edith could have picked that horse up and swung him around her head a few times.
You are quite strong, Miss Corkle.
Yes, I take after my mother.
Well, how is your mother?
At Rush, didn't I tell you to trot to the kitchen after sugar?
Yes, but
trot.
I...
Trot, this minute.
How is your mother?
Mother refused
exactly
to listen
we
to Vernon and I.
What she was going to do.
Those
she
men from Peoria talked her into playing football.
You want to
tell us here?
No,
go ahead. All right. Mother refused
exactly
to listen to
we
Vernon and I, and...
You go ahead, dear.
No, you.
All right. Mr. and Mrs. Cook, Mother did exactly what we were afraid she was going to do. She joined that lady's professional football team.
Really?
And next Saturday, she travels to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and plays a game against a bunch of men from the coal mines.
She's got her football suit and cleated shoes and padded pants and helmet and sweater with the picture of the snarling mountain lion on it and everything else.
She spent the morning ramming into the side of the house to toughen her shoulder muscles. It frightened the neighbors, and they called the police, and...
The police said she had to quit disturbing the peace and gave her warning.
My mother could take on any three of them policemen.
Yeah, I figured I'd miss out. Of course, you're all through talking about Mrs. Corkle's mother.
Mister, you put that cup of sugar on the library table, and then don't make a sound. There's been just a few too many remarks from 14-year-old boys.
Uh-huh.
It's just disgraceful. A professional football player. Why, my father would turn over in his grave.
She says she's strong. Well, sure, she's strong. That goes without saying. But she's not really well.
No, she's not.
Edith and I have consulted doctor after doctor. One has said one thing and another has said another thing, but we have our own private diagnoses. It all boils down to this.
If only Mother just didn't...
I know. If Mother didn't get so tired.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
After she's made a touchdown or two there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania next Saturday, playing against those rough coal miners, I bet she'll be so tired she'll be ready to drop. She'll see.
Yes.
Let's go home.
Yes, I think we better.
It must be getting just dreadfully late.
Not at all. Thanks so much for the sugar, Miss Gook.
Oh, wish any time.
Well, are Mr. Husband and baby brother ready to go?
No. Uh-huh.
Come on, then.
Ouch.
What's the matter?
My foot. It hurts just fierce.
Can you walk on it?
Not without pain.
I'll carry you.
Gee, will you, Eva?
Sure.
You going to carry him clear to the 700 block on West Mulberry, Miss Corkle?
Sure.
By George. All right, Edith. Pick me up.
Which concludes another brief visit at the small house halfway up on the next block. Well, sir, it's late afternoon as our scene opens now, and here in the living room of the small house halfway up on the next block, we find Mrs. Victor Gook and her neighbor, Mrs. Florence Harris. Mrs. Harris is holding forth somewhat intensely as we join the ladies, and we hear her saying,
I was completely perplexed. I said, Miss Donahue, aren't you even going upstairs and see what it was that fell? No, she said. It probably doesn't amount to anything.
It was in the attic that something fell, huh?
I'm positive it was the attic.
What's going on in that attic?
See, I've run over to return Miss Donahue's meat grinder I borrowed when mine went on the blink last week. We were standing there in the kitchen, and we heard this crash from up above. It had to be the attic. Because if it had been in the back bedroom right over our heads, it would have been simply deafening. It was the attic, all right. Oh, I pretty near jumped out of my shoes. What on earth was that, I said. Something dropped, I guess, Miss Donahue said. And then tried to change the subject. Can you imagine having something crash to your attic floor and not going up to investigate?
No. And now let me tell you something about Donahue's attic. Twice last week.
Oh, I believe I heard somebody in the kitchen.
Oh, yes, that's Irvin, my groceries. Irvin, groceries?
Afternoon, lady, honey.
Your uncle.
Hello, Uncle Fletcher.
In the living room, are they?
Yes.
Miss Gook, there's something I'd like to take up with your uncle, and I'm just wondering if I shouldn't do it right here and now and with you present.
Why, how you mean, Miss Harris?
Oh, it's not very pleasant.
Oh?
Hey, she's sharp out. Can't be more than 25 degrees. I was riding on Gumpox's garbage wagon and I liked the fruit. Well, Miss Harris, ma'am.
How do you do, Mr. Raj?
I got no pain. I got no cough. There was a snake on my coat lapel. I brush it off. That's what the dead game sports all say in St. Paul, Minnesota, when they want to coax the titter out of their sweetheart. I got no pain, I got no cough. If there was a snake on my coat lapel, I'd brush it off.
There is a potato peeling on your coat lapel, Uncle Fletcher.
That comes from riding on Gumpox's garbage wagon. Almost unavoidable. I challenge the most fastidious half-wit on the face of the earth to spend an hour on Gumpox's garbage wagon and remain tight. You just watch that fastidious half-wit. He'll find a stalk of celery or a chunk of bacon rind in his hair. Miss Harris, ma'am, you're looking mournful as a zebra. Did Dwight 26er forget to drop your mash notes and the sack of peppermint chocolate eclairs today?
Miss Harris is troubled about something, Uncle Fletcher.
You'll enjoy that. No, but you give me the most fastidious numbskull you can dig up. Let me put him on Gumpox's garbage wagon for just 1 hour. If he don't crawl down out of that garbage wagon with a watermelon seed plastered to his chin or an eggshell caught in his necktie, I'll swallow a Stilson wrench and I won't ask for cream and sugar.
Do you feel like talking about what it is that bothers you, Miss Harris?
Yes, I do. Miss Gook, it's about your uncle forcibly bringing my father home all the time.
Has he done that again?
He done it several times last week, And he done it this morning.
No.
Father's getting so he's afraid to go outdoors.
What conversational topic has sprung up now? Hey, I'll tell you, ladies of Fathead Thing. A gang of a different ones was skulking down to the interurban station.
Uncle Fletcher, the conversational topic that sprung up is you. I understand you brought poor old Mr. Sprawl home again this morning.
Yes. Did Mrs. Harris thank you here for that early?
Exactly the opposite.
It wasn't nothing.
Mr. Rush, my father's an elderly man. The doctor says he has to have fresh air and sunshine.
It wasn't nothing.
And you're making him so he hesitates to even go out on the street.
It wasn't nothing. It wasn't nothing.
Uncle Fletcher, pay attention to what Miss Harris is saying. She's not paying you compliments. She's upset.
No, it never inconvenienced me in the slightest. No, it wasn't.
Uncle Fletcher, listen.
Beg pardon, Sadie?
You're not being praised and complimented. This business is just the opposite.
Sadie, honey, I...
Miss Harris is troubled and upset. She wants you to leave her father alone.
Ladies, aren't we growing a shade excitable?
Miss Harris, you've got to stop.
Now, just what is our trouble? One at a time now. Easy does it. Miss Harris, ma'am, suppose I hear what you have to say first. Sadie, honey, you just listen for a minute.
You just listen for a minute. After this, you are to leave Miss Harris's father, Mr. Sprawl, strictly alone. Do you understand that?
Do I interpret you to mean... Miss Harris, ma'am, you object to my taking your father into custody and using my own personal time and seeing that he gets home safely out of the freezing weather?
I certainly do object. And so does Father. Why, he said this morning you pinned his arms down to his sides and forced him to walk the opposite way from where he was headed.
He resisted me.
Oh, he did, huh? Well, what right have you got
He resisted me. He resisted me. Naturally, I pinned his arms down to his side.
Well, what right have you got to pin my father when he arms down to his side?
Hey,
what's going on in there?
Miss Harris, give me a straight answer to this question. You object to my taking your father into custody?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
That's what we're trying to tell you.
Hey, what's going on?
This poor old chap was walking along University Avenue there, and his shawl was flanked way down by his elbow, and his half-wit baby bonnet was fleenced alongside one ear.
What affair was that of yours? He was on his way to the grocery store, and it's about the fifth time he's been on his way to the grocery store and been brought back by the scruff of his neck.
Hey, what's all this?
Miss Harris, ma'am, I can only say this.
Dr. Miller says my father's to have plenty of fresh air and sunshine. You've got him so he's on the point of hiding in the basement.
Miss Harris, ma'am, I can only say
you that... describe this pitiful picture of my father standing out on the sidewalk, forlorn and neglected. He's my father, and I'm responsible for him, and he's not forlorn and neglected. If the weather isn't all right, I wouldn't allow him to leave the house in the first place.
Hello, Sadie.
Hello. Uncle Fletcher, you don't mean to do anything wrong. You mean just fine.
There he stood, poor old chap. His shawl yunched down alongside his elbow, and his sad little baby bonnet geeked on top of his ear.
All right. Splendid. But, Mr. Rush, the next time you see my father with his shawl yunched along his elbow and his baby bonnet geeked on the top of his ear, you just go right along and follow your nose and tend to your own affairs.
Hello, Sage.
What?
Hello.
How would you like it, Uncle Fletcher, if somebody bigger and stronger than you made it their business to chase you home the minute you set your foot outdoors on the sidewalk?
Vic, honey, I appeal to you.
No, Father.
Suppose that crony of yours, Sweet Corn McBlock, grabbed you by the collar every time you took a notion to go skulk in the interurban station.
Vic, honey, you are an intelligent man.
No, I'm not. I'm a fathead. Let me out of this.
Miss Brooks, do you know what happened after dinner this noon?
No, what?
Father went outdoors in front of the house and saw a man walking along the street and thought it was Mr. Rush and began to run.
Run? At his age?
Yes. He began to run. And he fell down.
Did he hurt himself?
No, but he could have.
Why, he could have broke his hip or something.
He could have killed himself.
And the running?
Yes, and the running. He came in the house all out of breath and exhausted.
Uncle Fletcher, did you hear that?
I believe Vic here will back me up in the statement which I am about to make at this time.
No.
Uncle Fletcher, did you know that Mr. Sprawl ventured out on the street this afternoon and saw a man and thought it was you and started to run and fell down?
I will elaborate on that.
Oh, Miss Cook, I'm ashamed of myself. coming over into your home and talking loud and sharp the way I've been doing, but I felt so strongly about this business.
Oh, sure, I'd have done it myself.
Mr. Gook, I let myself get so excited, I never even noticed you come in.
Good afternoon, Miss Harris.
Good afternoon.
We, all of us, have human weaknesses, and it's useless to deny it. Reverend Fumpaw K. Ying of Belvedere, Illinois, who passed away in 1909, used to tell his congregations, earthbound creatures never knew the extent of human frailty.
Hello!
But that trees and vegetables must survive the blistering storm.
Your father.
Yes.
Reverend Fumpaw K. Ying delivered himself of that sentiment for the last time in 1906.
I'm in the living room, Father.
In 1907, he weakened. In 1908, they sent for the relations in Ohio, and in 1909, the soul left the body, and Reverend Yeen was taken to Phoenix, Indiana, and given decent burial.
Good afternoon, Mr. Sprawl.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gook. Good afternoon, Mrs. Gook.
Hello, Mr. Sprawl.
Hello, Florence. No.
Hello, Sprawl.
No, no, go away.
What's the matter, Sprawl?
No, no, go away. Keep him off me, Florence.
Father, wait. What are you going to do? No, Father, stop. You can't crawl under the Davenport. Father, get up.
Which concludes another brief visit at the small house halfway up in the next block.
And it also concludes our small visit for this week. We'll be back next week with some more old-time radio. Please join us then.